This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Well, welcome all here today. It's a good thing that we're coming together, learning about meditation and the Buddha's teachings. And we often hear about mindfulness in this world. But the Buddha's teachings, mindfulness is just one part of it. So being aware of the breath or the body throughout the day or with one's meditation object. The Buddha, first of all, focused on generosity and kindness and acts of goodwill and all these kind of things as a foundation for the heart. So when we come to meditate, we have a foundation of goodness to rely on. And I know from my own path, from becoming a Buddhist, I originally was coming along to the Armadale group back in 2012, 2013. When I found out about it before I came to the monastery. And there was a time in my life where I realized that I hadn't been helping other people enough. And so I started by, I was on a retreat at Jhana Grove and put my name down to volunteer helping the gardens there, which is the retreat center down the road here. And then just by associating, coming out every week or two to help with the gardens, I ended up coming along to the monastery. And then I used to enjoy buying a whole bunch of food to go into the freezer and things like that, and volunteering time to drive the monks around and help with things when I could. And when I look back, you know, that kind of generosity is a great boon for the heart, because it means that you know, you're trying to help other people, you're trying to do good things, and so it's just a natural way of having more goodness in your life. And then when you come to learn meditation, it's just a matter of starting to put down the tendencies of our minds, like thinking about the past, worrying about things that have gone, people who have passed away, thinking about our work, worrying about the future. All these things are just proliferations of the mind. You know, in Buddhism we call them the five hindrances. They're the things that the mind gets caught up in that stop us from settling down into the present moment. And so after generosity is a foundation. I mean, also when the Buddha taught about generosity, you know, help feeding the monks and nuns, offering the requisites, offering the robes and the lodgings, the medical requisites and the food. And these are the kind of things the Buddha recommended. And he said to associate with people who are wise. So our spiritual friends in life, we try and focus on people who are wise. But then we go beyond that and also, you know, poor people, sick family members, homeless people, monks and nuns of other traditions. And we go out of our way to help people who require the aid and assistance. And then the Buddha said that this generosity is a great boon. And the more we become generous as people, then the more naturally we become thankful and grateful for the things in our lives. And we actually look for opportunities to, as it's said about the God Sakka, paving the way to heaven through good actions. And rather than focusing on the results of the good actions, just to do goodness for the sake of doing goodness, to be somebody whose heart overflows and tries to find ways to go beyond selfish thoughts and to be, you know, humble and kind and just have a giving nature. And one of the teachings in Buddhism is where we get to the point where we start to realize that nobody has done anything to us. So if somebody comes along and hits us or shouts at us, we just have kind thoughts towards them. And then suddenly we start to give up that victimhood nature. It doesn't mean we're a doormat, but at the same time we don't allow the external world to shape our internal weather system. We allow our good actions and the focus of our mind to be something which is beautiful. And then that inner beauty is something which the Buddha pointed at as a source for us to stand upon. So you have the generosity and then the sila. And when the Buddha spoke about sila, which is kind of virtuous precepts or moral precepts, it was specifically the five precepts for lay people as a foundation. And these are things that are not, in as far as Buddhism is concerned, not to be overlooked, because if one cultivates these five things, there's something that prevents rebirth in lower realms, but also just by investigating them, you can see not killing a little living being. Like a moth doesn't want to die, it's just a moth. Even a cockroach doesn't want to die, it's just a cockroach. We don't want to die. And so the natural state of beings is they don't want to die. So when we avoid killing, then, you know, we're moving towards harmlessness. We're moving towards looking out for the welfare of other beings. And so it starts with this kind of prevention from a bad action, but then at the same time it starts to beautify our minds. And we can look up the five precepts, but they start as a something to physically that we do, or mentally, and then the more as we practice that, it's something that comes into our heart. So then we naturally start to see through cause and effect, oh, okay, if I drink alcohol, if I take drugs, then I can't meditate, and then I'm not a trustworthy person because I'm not aware of what I'm doing. And so we kind of can learn step by step what these five precepts are as a foundation. So then we have the generosity as a foundation and the sila, which is the virtuous precept. And then the Buddha specifically says that the purpose of sila is that it leads to blamelessness. So then you have this, one of the recollections for virtue is it's unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise and ungrasped at, leading to samadhi. So it's this whole process where Just reflecting on your own goodness, on your own virtue, becomes a process where the mind gathers and becomes bright. And so the more we try to gather towards the good things in our life, the generosity and the virtuous precepts, then naturally the samadhi, or as Ajahn Chah called samadhi, is like the strength of the mind, then naturally that becomes stronger, because our tendencies towards following paths of evil or bad actions starts to lessen, because we focus on what is good and we encourage what is good and we move towards what is good. And I like to speak about these things, because then they start to understand how the mind works. So then the third factor that the Buddha taught for lay people was bhavana. And bhavana is like mental cultivation, because he said that the household life is crowded and dusty, where the life gone forth is open and free. And the point is that when you're in a household life, you have houses to look after, you have families to look after, you have jobs, you know, have to work with the sweat of your brow, and it's difficult to find the time to practice spiritually, and the merits are great for doing so, but we have to look at, you know, the causes of making time to coming along to things like meditation and taking out quiet time, meditating in monasteries, and giving of our wealth, and learning how to act in a way that is balanced. So like with even like with finances, the Buddha would teach how you need to save for a rainy day, and how you can save for your business and your family, but also to have put aside some money that you can donate towards monks and nuns, and you know, be have gifts of charity. So you learn to be balanced in all aspects of our life. And then when we come to meditate, then we can have this chaganusati, which is recollection of generosity, or silanusati, which is recollection of the sila, the virtuous precepts. And what's interesting is these are very similar to the how the Buddha explains breath meditation. So the actual process of the mind becoming inspired, joy arising, the body becoming tranquil, and then eventually the mind gathering into samadhi, into this kind of strength and stillness, is the same process. So we have a way of using bhavana in our daily life to actually be developing these positive qualities. So then when we do come to meditate and we do seek out spiritual places, we've been spending time throughout our days, our weeks, cultivating the mind. And I think that that's important to see a way of settling the mind, because what happens is when we come to meditate, I think in the West we have a very big focus on meditation, but if we put the causes in place and focus on learning to be a thankful and grateful person, learning to be generous, learning to keep our precepts, then naturally our mind will become bright. And this is a foundation. So that was a little introduction into dana, sila, and bhavana, which is like generosity or giving, sila, which is virtuous precepts, and bhavana, which is cultivation of mind. So that gives a background of the way that I've come into meditation. And I think what's useful about that is then you're never far away from meditation, because you've been spending your time watching over your mind and learning to let go of evil actions and gather towards good actions. Then whenever you come to meditate, it doesn't take long to be able to settle down into the peace and tranquility, and then to use that to contemplate about things like impermanence and have an understanding of death and these kinds of things. So, yes, that's a little introduction, but is there any questions on that so far? Anybody spark anything they would like to say? It's a bit hard for me not to talk about Buddhist teachings because I'm a Buddhist monk. So forgive me. But yeah, I really think, like Ajahn Chah, one of Ajahn Chah's simile was, if you have a big apple and a small apple, give the big apple away even if it hurts. And the idea is that, you know, we've got to go against the grain to learn to be generous. We're in a world where we're taught to be miserly and that, you know, to protect what we own and not be of a giving nature. Where Buddhism teaches us the way of the Buddha is a path of giving. So we learn how to still be balanced, but to also be ready to give and give with an open heart. And another way of cultivating that similar kind of vibe is mudita, which is the third of the Brahma Viharas, appreciative joy. And so if you're ever finding that the mind is a bit dull or you don't find the heart opening up, like Ajahn Sangharatna's meditation the other week, learning to do metta or any of the first three of the Brahma Viharas, which is metta, compassion, or appreciative joy, they're things that open up the heart. And so I would recommend, as a part of the breath meditation and present moment awareness, to develop metta meditation and just dedicate a little bit of time every day or every week to developing that. Because the benefit of that is eventually you don't have any enemies. There's not a single being that could do anything to you where you couldn't meditate for, you know, 5 minutes without letting go of any emotions or difficulties that had come up. So, and when you don't have any enemies in this world, it means no, you know, not even a Mara or a demon could come along and, you know, you'd still be able to wish them good thoughts. So it's that beautifying of the mind. And a final thing, now we're getting close to our meditation, is when you're practicing present moment awareness, the Buddha simile and like breath meditation, first of all, is to come to a meditation object that suits you. So usually the Buddha would teach like breath meditation or some kind of body meditation, and there's many in the greater discourse on mindfulness, which is in Majjhima Nikaya, and I think another one in Digha Nikaya, which are two of the collections of the Buddha's teachings. And then they give a series, so like four elements, for example. You could contemplate the four elements, or you could contemplate the parts of the body, or you could contemplate the breath. And so these are called mindfulness of the body. And they're like the foundation of meditation, because there's something that's with you. Also body awareness, some people just being aware, like being inside their body through the day, being aware, you know, right arm moving, left arm, so on, is a way of them coming into the present. So you find the meditation that suits you and then try to use it regularly. So I find if you come back to your meditation object throughout the day, it's kind of like little drips of mindfulness gathering. So then when you come to your meditation, whenever you have more time to practice, you've kept the kettle ready to boil. So you haven't let it kind of thrown it all away. And so that kind of mindfulness, then coming back to the very first point, and that's where it comes in, that the mindfulness throughout the day of watching over our minds, being mindful and attentive to what's coming in out of the mind, and also coming back to our meditation object. These are things that allow the meditation to deepen. And then you find it's like any skill, you know, like a master pianist, they start by doing the same scales again and again and again and learning simple things. And then slowly over time, their intuition and their skill develops. And so it's just like that. And so it's something that takes time and perseverance, but it's very worthwhile. And the mindfulness of the body, so we have these six senses. We have the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. And the Buddha simile was like there were six animals tied together. And usually when the one animal, say the eye, which is a snake, when it sees a form, it pulls all the animals over this direction. And then the mind thinks a thought, and it pulls all the animals over that direction. And so you have this constant battle of these animals which are tied together, pulling everybody this way and that. And so by the time we get to the evening, we're completely exhausted and our minds are burnt out. And so what meditation is learning to tie the animals to a post. And then the animals can stand or lay down or sit, but they're tied to the post. And so every time the mind goes off somewhere, we just gently remind it that we're doing the meditation. Now is not the time to get involved with the sense contact. And we come back to the meditation object. And then if we try and do that with an open heart and focus on good qualities, the process gets easier. And then eventually the mind can stay with the meditation object. And then that's where the mindfulness of the body is kind of supreme. And the Buddha was taught that as the foundation for then going further into the mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of mental states, and mindfulness of like dhammas or truths, where you actually can reflect upon what is the Eightfold Path and what are the three characteristics of existence. And you can use the power of the calm that you've developed to actually look into the truth of reality. So we have 3 minutes to our first half an hour. So maybe that's good enough for a beginning. So we'll do half an hour of meditation, maybe a few extra minutes, and then open up to some questions or a discussion afterwards. So if you start by getting yourself into a comfortable position, okay, so just usually I start by just taking a few deep breaths and just allow all the tension to unwind. And this is a useful technique if you find the mind proliferating during the meditation. Ajahn Chah would suggest this. You just take a few deep breaths, relax, and then return to the meditation. So just allow all tension to leave the body. And start by relaxing the toes. Excuse me. Relaxing the feet. Relaxing the ankles. Relaxing the lower legs. Relaxing the knees, the thighs, the hips, and the waist. Just allowing all tension in the legs to dissolve into the earth. Relaxing the weight of the body onto the seat or the cushion. And just become aware of the belly as it rises and falls with the breath. Rises and falls. Relax the lower back, the middle back, the diaphragm and the solar plexus. Relax the upper back, all tension unwinding. Relax the chest and the heart. Letting go of all tension in the heart. And relax the lungs. And just become aware of the lungs as they fill up and empty. Relax the shoulders. So much tension held in the shoulders. Just allow them to unwind and relax. Relax the upper arms, the elbows, the lower arms, the wrists, the hands, and the fingertips. Relax the neck and throat. Relax the chin, the jaw, the lips, the tongue, under the nose, the nostrils, the upper cheeks. Relax under the eyes, letting all tension dissolve. Relax the eyelids, and the eyes themselves. So much tension held in the eyes. Just become aware of the whole of the eyes and allow them to unwind and relax. As we start to give away all of our concerns and worries, thoughts and agitations, just completely relax the eyes. This tingly sensation spreading through the eyes. As the eyes relax deeper and deeper. Relax the temples, the eyebrows, and above the eyebrows, the forehead. Just allow all tension to dissolve. As this tingly sensation spreads through the whole of the face, the whole of the head, the whole of the body. So the body is relaxed. We let the body go, whatever it needs to do during the meditation, just allow it to quietly look after itself. Relax the eyes deeper and deeper, and our attention remains. And we bring our attention to our minds, whatever you want to call it, the heart, the mind, the spiritual mind, that thing that's here in the present moment. Our experience. And just allow the mind not to flow out into the world. It usually flows out this way and that, to restlessness, to desire, to anger, to doubts, to sloth and torpor. This is where the mind flows out into the world. Instead, we allow the mind to flow into the present moment, giving up the past, giving up the future, giving up proliferation about the present and an imagination. Just allowing the mind to be bright like a sun set free from the clouds, not a care in the world. Just allow ourselves to forget about any worries and concerns, to give up any tendencies to think about this and that. Wherever the mind goes off, we just become aware of it, allow it to do as it pleases, but gently let go of that tendency, and we come back to the present moment. It's very soft, like a bird flying from its nest and coming back again. The nest is snug, so every time we fly off, we just become aware where the mind is going and bring it back. We're like a bird snug in the nest. Nowhere to go, nothing to do. And we can bring the attention to the breath. Whatever is the most natural way of perceiving the breath, we bring our attention to an in-breath and to an out-breath. An in-breath born, lives, and dies, and the out-breath is born, lives, and dies. Each one is separate. Anapanasati, awareness of the in-breath, awareness of the out-breath. It's like we try and be friends with the in-breath, be friends with the out-breath. Just like we would attend to a dear friend or a teacher, so we attend to the in-breath and we attend to the out-breath. We have interest with the breath. Kind of an earnest friendship. There's nothing more important in the whole universe, the whole ambrosial, than one in-breath and one out-breath. Try and have a thankful and grateful heart, so we're upright and bright, awake to one in-breath, awake to one out-breath. Anytime the bird flies off, we're just reminded of this activity we've chosen to do. Let it come back to be snug in the nest again. Being friends with one in-breath. Being friends with one out-breath. A heart of friendliness. Welcoming. You might begin to become aware of the whole of the in-breath, the whole of the out-breath. As if it had its own melody and you were tuning into it. Its own feeling. Begin to tranquilize the breath, allowing any lingering agitation or hindrance to become tranquil and peaceful as we breathe in, sensing the tranquility as we breathe out, sensing the tranquility. And then like the feeling of gratitude, we start to have this sense of joyfulness with the in-breath. Very subtle joy, joyfulness with the out-breath. With a happy, grateful, thankful heart, joyfully breathing in, joyfully breathing out. Like a dear friend or a teacher, attending to one in-breath, attending to one out-breath. This tingly, joyful sensation starts to become fuller and fuller. We become aware of the mind, the moods of the mind. And let go of any lingering tendencies. We allow the mind to become happy with the in-breath, the mind to become happy with the out-breath, like the heart is smiling, set free from the clouds, not a care in the world. Like a glad mind, gladness with the in-breath, gladness with the out-breath. Like a bird snug in the nest. It's gladness and contentment just to be with one in-breath, just to be with one out-breath. Like the heart set free from the clouds, not a care in the world. Gladness just to be with one in-breath, gladness just to be with one out-breath. Sense of ease and gladness, just to be with one in-breath. Sense of ease and gladness, just to be with one out-breath. With this happy in-breath and happy out-breath, allow the mind to gather into peace. Gathering into peace with the in-breath. Gathering into peace with the out-breath. Like an unshakable stillness. Unshakable peace. Gathering into peace with the in-breath. Gathering into peace with the out-breath. With a smiling heart, gathering into peace with the in-breath, gathering into peace with the out-breath. A sense of unshakable peace. The bright heart. Unshakable peace. still like a dear friend or a teacher, attending to the in-breath, attending to the out-breath, we're gathering into peace, into unshakable stillness. Freeing the mind, breathing in. Freeing the mind, breathing out. The mind, the heart, the spiritual mind. The whole of one's experience. Freeing the mind, breathing in. Freeing the mind, breathing out. Sense of liberation, freedom, emancipation. Freeing the mind, breathing in. Freeing the mind, breathing out. Freeing the mind, breathing in. Freeing the mind, breathing out. And with this inner sense of happiness, repleteness, contentment, and freedom, see if we can see the impermanence of one in-breath. See the impermanence of one out-breath. Don't hold tight, just allow one in-breath to form and disappear, one out-breath to form and disappear. And see it's fading away, as once it begins to fade away. As the out-breath begins, it begins to fade away. And see its end. The in-breath has an end. And the out-breath has an end. And then relinquish, relinquishing the in-breath, relinquishing the out-breath. This untying, untethering, relinquishing the in-breath, relinquishing the out-breath. relinquishing the in-breath, relinquishing the out-breath. Letting go, untying, renouncing. Now, we're at the end of the meditation. Just take a moment to wish ourselves well. Thank ourselves for the willingness to practice. That we can pave a way to heaven in our own hearts, to this brightness and goodness, living in the present moment, learning to be a good person, learning to cultivate good spiritual qualities. Have a sense of gratitude to ourselves for the willingness to practice, and gratitude to those tuning into this recording. And we share a sense of mudita, appreciative joy, this celebration for wholesome spiritual qualities with all beings in the ambrosial and the three realms of existence. Sadhu, sadhu, may all beings continue being joyful with a happy and equanimous heart. That brings us to the end of the meditation.
Yeah, that's very good. Thank you, Venerable.
Most great. Welcome. Most welcome. Any questions that springs to mind to anybody or comments?
I think everybody's muted.
Okay. You're welcome to unmute yourselves if you have a question or comment. Okay, if you don't. So that was a bit of a journey. I've been, every now and then I dive a bit into the 16 steps of Anapanasati, which is how the Buddha taught meditation. So that was a little bit of a journey to give you a taste of that. What's interesting about it is the four final factors where you use the joy of your meditation, the happiness, the stillness, the peace, to then see the impermanence of even the in-breath and the out-breath, and then to be able to relinquish these things. Because when we look at our lives, a practitioner looks at their life, it's like, we don't want to be brought together with things we don't like, and we don't want to be parted from things that we like. So our whole lives we're building up these attachments and aversions, and it makes it very hard when we come to separation, or we meet with people who are angry, or we die unexpectedly. And so meditation and the Buddhist path is learning to brighten the heart now with good actions, to gather towards good and to learn to avoid evil and bad. And there's a process of this brightening the mind and learning to be a good person. We literally are paving a path to heaven in our own hearts. And it doesn't mean we need to be reborn in heaven, but it just means that we have the power of our own mental states and our own world in our hands. It's easy to get caught up in worldly dharmas, where we have televisions and newspapers which are pulling us this way and that. But when we take our own lives into our own emotional qualities, our own inner world into our hands, then we can choose which way we want to go. And the Buddha always said that the happy, fast path was the path that he recommended. So learning to be skillful in our use of Dhamma, which is like truths, learning about what is true, what is not true, associating with wise people, but then not just having those maps and looking at them, but trying to put them into action. And so the Buddhas and the enlightened beings, they only point the way. We have to, practitioners have to do the practice themselves. And the meditation is very important because it's a way of learning to still and calm our minds. And then with that power of stillness and calm, then we can contemplate without, as Ajahn Tate once said, it's like if you had a feather and you put it close to the fire, the feather will shrivel. And so contemplation is like that. If your mind doesn't have sufficient energy, sufficient peace and happiness, if you start contemplating Dhamma or thinking about things that have passed away, then it might make your mind sad. And so the meditation is the way of balancing our mind so we strengthen this peace, this inner stability, so then when we come to contemplate Dhamma and learn what is and is not the path through our own wisdom, our own understanding. And sometimes our understanding is wrong, but then the more we practice, we correct. It's just like a ship on the ocean. You know, they're not always going in exactly a straight line. They have a compass and they're constantly going this way and that and correcting their destination. And so that's what we have, this kind of spiritual compass where we associate with good people, with wise people, and try and find our way in life and aspire to be a good person, a generous person, thankful, grateful person, and aspire to become wise. And sometimes the Dhamma can be a bit scary because there's so many teachings, and because the Buddha, all the words that he spoke in his life are recorded in books. But, you know, the practice can be very simple as well, where we just take a simple thing like learning to be good and gathering towards goodness. And when we notice we're going the wrong way, just let go of those things, change our behavior, and learn skillful means to not do those things. And, you know, I've constantly faced this kind of thing where you fix one area and one area is going well, and then another area decays, and then that kind of goes backwards a bit. And so there's this constant trying to balance all the areas and overcome the five hindrances. And there's a teaching the Buddha gave called the Silaika Sutta, where he lists 44 things that lead to enlightenment. And they're all the kind of, has perfecting the Eightfold Path as a part of it, which is a foundational path in Buddhism. But then it also has all of the kind of the defilements of mind. So, you know, learning to overcome like avarice, which is like greedy materialism, and learning to overcome anger and lust and all these things. And so bit by bit, I suppose the power of the meditation is just then used to turn back on ourselves to see, you know, what is the area we need to do work in. And then even just the process of thinking, oh, you know, this is wrong, I shouldn't be doing this, how can I rectify this? You know, if you think that thought enough time over weeks and months, eventually you will overcome that. And that's when the Buddha talks about the power of thoughts. It's like the high road over the low road, or like a ford where you're crossing a river. There's a safe way of crossing and there's a dangerous way of crossing. And so we just have these ways of contemplating our actions where slowly we rectify them. So, you know, we're not expected to be perfect and we're not expected to believe the Dhamma, but we just take one little thing at a time and we see, killing living beings, actually, that's really good, you know. even if I've got mosquitoes on me and moths flying around, and just try and have some kindness towards them. You know, they could be our great grandmother, we don't know, and they're just a living being. And then so, you know, it turns the practice back into our mind, and then we see, okay, this is just something that's going to take some time for me to work on. And then I like the idea of the one teacher once told me, like, saving for a rainy day. So, you know, most people, it's a good practice to save for a rainy day. So then if something bad goes wrong in your life, you have some savings there to help you through that period. And this is like what we do with our meditation. So, for example, it took me a while when I was a layperson to give up alcohol. And then eventually I think I did a pact with my brother, and then so we wouldn't drink for 6 months. But I'd had a period of time, 3 months here, 3 months there. But I ended up having to break association with friends that drank for that period. But the act of making that promise with my brother then made me keep it. And it was not too long before I came to the monastery. And even though I'd had many periods where I didn't drink, it was just such a strong habit it took a while to break. And of course now I can see the benefits of avoiding drug and alcohol, because they're things that we just use to escape. And then it makes it harder for the mind to settle in meditation. And the mind isn't as subtle and refined as it can become. So that's just one example of how I kind of, you know, through a process of reflection, looked back at the mind and eventually overcame one of the precepts which I hadn't perfected. And now, you know, as Buddhist monks, we have 227 precepts. And then the Buddha has a thing called dukkhitas, where we have like another 1,000 or so minor offenses. Like, we're not meant to throw a rock off the top of a hill because it might kill somebody below, and this kind of thing. But the idea is, you know, you just try and come from that bright place of your heart, and you just learn what is good and what is not good, and occasionally reflect on the teachings of wise people like the Buddha to get some kind of guidance of which way to go. But I really do recommend the learning to be happy from a thankful and grateful heart. So rather than kind of looking at the problems in our lives, to see the good things. And whenever we have a dispute with somebody, to be willing to forgive and to look at the good qualities rather than the bad. Because I think there's a tendency in all of us to towards negativity and fault finding. And so it's just a way for us to forgive and see that none of us are perfect. And we don't know what defilements are in one person or another, or what character traits we're bringing with us from past lives, or if we just got out of bed on the wrong side. So that way we're kind of always ready to forgive and work with people in our lives rather than against them. And that's where the Brahmaviharas, like learning the metta meditation, is very useful, because you start with yourself, and then either spread out into the directions, or there's various procedures of doing it. But the idea is eventually then, from having metta to all beings, then you even have metta to enemies, to the point where you don't have enemies anymore. But like anything, it's a skill that needs to be developed. So we can't expect when we're angry to suddenly have metta in our hearts. So this is where the saving for a rainy day comes in. So these little practices where we see, okay, maybe I'm not generous enough, so I need to give the big apple instead of the small apple, and even though it hurts. And then eventually giving the big apple brings joy in your heart. But to begin with, you have to go against those strong tendencies to learn to be thankful and grateful and giving. And so that's just an example of, in Buddhism we have this word called asava, which is like the mind flowing out into the world. And so what we're actually doing is bringing the mind to unify into brightness. So rather than diversify, even in equanimity, if it's diversified, you're constantly still settling things. So by bringing the mind in to one point, then we're unifying the mind into brightness without any cares or worries. And then we can use that power of the mind to let go of defilements and see the tendencies that are leading us in the wrong direction. How are we going? 8:12. So, any questions from what I've said? Or comments?
You have to unmute yourself if you want to speak. I think everybody is muted at the moment. You can unmute yourselves.
That's okay. I can continue on.
No, that was good. When you talked about the first building block about generosity, that's the important thing. So I sort of, it's when you're reacting to something or to someone, and I'm still at the stage where it's only afterwards when I said, oh, I should have done that, shouldn't have done that. So I'm still getting into the thing, as you said, about the being mindful all day, or trying to be mindful, so that you're ready to go. So I'm just trying to get to that stage.
I find the Thai, like in Thailand, Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Mun, they would have like a what's called a parikama. So they'd have a word or a sentence that they would say. And there's a kind of like this preparatory meditation object. So like Buddha or Dhammo or Sangho or some kind of inspirational sentence like that. And so usually they would say Buddha or Dhammo or Sangho. But what you can do is have like your normal meditation and then have like a parikama, this word or series of words that you say. And then so when you're going about your normal daily activities, then you just say Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. It's useful because then you know when your mind's gone off. And sometimes when you're beginning the practice, you know, you may be an hour before you remember to do it again. And then you're doing it for 5 minutes and then you forget. But then, like anything, it's a muscle that develops. And it's quite useful because it allows the mind to have a focus so that you're not just proliferating and thinking. Because we all have that tendency when we're doing jobs, we kind of get lost in them. And so I've always found that quite a useful kind of reminder. And particularly for people who think a lot, parikama is a useful technique. And
thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, the generosity though, that's one of the recollections the Buddha gave is that, you know, basically in this world that is stained with miserliness, so it's like this, the general tendency of the mind is towards, you know, it's mine, hold on to it, don't share it, like this is just like how the world is conditioned. And so, and we all have this kind of in us a little bit, and the Buddha said to the monks that if we knew what he knew, then we would never give a meal without giving. And then he gave the example, even when we have the rinsing of our bowl, that then we go and offer that to the ants and the insects or the animals. And then so it's like every time you have an opportunity to give, then you will give. And so, and that's having little things like that through the day, little acts of kindness, acts of generosity, is, you know, very powerful. And it's giving people the benefit of the doubt, like even if somebody, also we don't always get along with people, sometimes there's different characters, but always seeing the difficult people and difficult things in our lives as an opportunity to let go and forgive and look at the better possibility of that. So actually the teaching the Buddha gave to the monks was quite extreme. And when these monks were arguing, and then the Buddha gave a teaching called the simile of the saw. And the way it, in brief, it goes is, you know, if somebody's verbally abusing you, then you think, well, at least they're not throwing rocks at me. And then if they're throwing rocks at you, well, at least they haven't stabbed me. And then if they haven't stabbed me, well, at least they haven't sawn my arms off. And if they're tying you down, sawing your arms off, well, their actions are their own. But, you know, you still wish them well. So it's like you always have a way of looking at the world where you're not being a victim. There's nobody that can do anything to us if we're coming from a place of metta. And by having a heart of metta as well, then it means that beings respond to that. And actually, it's one of the qualities, like the devas actually really like the Brahmaviharas. So people who practice the Brahmaviharas a lot are tended to be looked after more by the devas just because they notice those beings, because their hearts are bright. I think the Buddha said in one life when he developed loving kindness meditation for 7 years, he wasn't reborn in the human world for 7 aeons, which is like 7 universes. So, that's the power of metta. It's these Brahmaviharas. So they're all interconnected. And I found for myself the appreciative joy. Once I developed the metta meditation, I really liked the appreciative joy. And that's nice because it opens the heart and you're focusing on the joy of people who have done good actions, that they may experience the joy from their good actions. So you're kind of wishing this celebration to all beings based on their wholesome karma. Just keeping it simple. So watching over the mind, and if you can't watch over the mind, then having a parikarma. And even if you just say, okay, once every hour I'm going to come back and say my word, even that's quite a strong practice, because you have to be watching over your mind all day long. And then eventually, the practices, it's like anything, like when you're learning to play the piano, you're learning the scales and you're learning this, and then as time goes on, you advance on to more and more kind of melodies until you're a master pianist. And the same is with meditation. The more we practice and create this kind of watching over the mind, good qualities, virtuous behavior, then they kind of all start to interconnect and be like a melody of goodness in our hearts. And that's why the Buddha said that virtue is like the scent that goes across all the winds. Where usually beautiful scent of incense travels with the wind, where the scent of virtue and goodness, that's even the devas, the celestial beings, can see that. All right, how are we going? 20 past. Okay.
Anybody got any questions?
Yes, just a question for Venerable. You mentioned at the end of the meditation the three realms. I just wondered what the three different realms were.
In Buddhism, you have the Kamaloka, and then can't remember the Pali now. So basically, they're the three realms of existence. So you have the lower realms and the higher realms and the formless realm. So there's like formless being. So in Buddhism, there's a thing called the five khandhas, which is like what we are made up of. It's like a way of seeing a being. So it's like form, earth, water, wind, fire, feeling, perception, volition, and then consciousness. And then in the higher realm, the formless realm, they don't have the form. So they just have the four mind elements. And then in the heavenly realm, they have like a refined, like a mental form. So they still have a body, but it's a very refined form, and they have very refined foods. So it's like when we're on earth, the actions that we do, good or bad, those results get stored up. And then we either use those results in our next births, so heavenly rebirth or rebirth in the animal realms or lower, or like a Buddha or an Arahant, or a person who's used the goodness of their hearts to actually overcome attachment to those five khandhas. So that's the three realms of existence are just to do with how refined the form of existence you are. And I like to say, I call it the ambrosial, because it's a bit different to the physical universe. It's like there's layers to it. So some some monks report, you know, who, like the right-hand disciple, left-hand disciple of the Buddha, Moggallana, some beings have such great, powerful samadhi, their mind is totally in samadhi, that they can actually see the beings in these realms all the time. And so if there happened to be some being of one of these realms that was coming along, they could actually see it with their own eyes. But that requires round-the-clock mindfulness and very strong meditation. So, but yeah, obviously not everybody will have that ability as well. So in Buddhism, we don't. There are psychic powers and things, but the Buddha was more taught us to use the power of our meditation to look into suffering and how to go beyond suffering. So that's the kind of the core teaching of the Buddha, is to see how our attachments inherently cause suffering, and going beyond attachment, being a noble being, going beyond attachment is the way to kind of go beyond suffering. And it's kind of unique in that we require the teachings of a Buddha to become enlightened, or we become a Pacheka Buddha, which is like, if there's no Buddha in the world, then it's like kind of a Buddha who can't teach. So they're the kind of the three ways of ending suffering. Is either through arahatship, which is like enlightenment from a teacher's teachings of the Buddha, being a Buddha, or being a Pacheka Buddha. Sorry, that was a bit of elaborate. So yeah, the three realms.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, the Buddha didn't tell us to blindly have faith as well. There's two main, some people get inspired by the teachings, and some people get inspired, like have faith in the Buddha and get inspired by the Buddha. And often the Buddha would teach the six recollections, which is recollection of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, recollection of virtue, recollection of generosity, and recollection of the quality of the devas. And that was his main teaching to lay people of how to practice, because they're the things that you can kind of think about and would just naturally inspire your minds. And so if you're ever feeling lacking in inspiration, then I suggest those contemplations. There's a great sutta called To Mahanama, where Mahanama talks about these six contemplations. Which is good, because even the virtue or the recollection of the quality of devas doesn't have too much to do with Buddhism. So you can still recollect on these things as you're gaining faith and trust. And so the Buddha was quite pragmatic in that he wanted people to, you know, see things for themselves. So like a stream winner, the first level of enlightenment, it's like somebody who's seen down the well, and they've seen the water is there, which is like, that means they know the Buddha's teachings is true. There is suffering and there is an end to suffering, but they just haven't worked out how to finish that journey yet. And so, but the idea is, yeah, it's just bit by bit. Like one teacher I met in Thailand said, it's just like one step at a time. So we get to a certain level in our practice, and then that's one the first step, and then we get to another level. And then, or another teacher said, it's like, to begin with, you have to attach to goodness. And then the goodness is like the rail going up the staircase. But once we get to the top of the staircase, we can let go of that rail. And so, interestingly, arahats are people, they've even gone beyond goodness and badness. They've gone beyond the eight worldly winds. But they did so by becoming supreme beings. So they perfected these Brahmaviharas, they perfected their meditation, and then they overcame suffering in their own hearts. So, and that's what the focus in the Buddha's teachings is about ending suffering in our own hearts. And so that's the kind of the greatest way we can be of benefit to ourselves and others. Okay, well, it's 8:27, so I think we did pretty well.
That's good, great, thank you. So appreciate your being here tonight, Venerable. Thanks very much.
That's welcome. Okay, I'll just do a little blessing. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ. May we all live with a heart of metta. May we all live with a heart of compassion. May we all live with a heart of appreciative joy. May we all live with a heart of equanimity. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, goodbye.